New gun control measures are moving forward in Florida as communities call for new ways to reduce violence, both in our schools and on the streets. Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. And thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live on the radio at 9. Also, make sure to subscribe to the daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead, gun reform advances in Tallahassee as activists have safety and justice on their minds. We're taking your calls on this right now. Your calls are already coming into the show. What's on your mind about this? Give us a call right now at 549-2937. Then later, thinking of running for office one day, we'll tell you how Leadership Jacksonville is teaching the candidates of the future the tools of the trade. Plus, the new app Relevant is plugging you into everything that's happening all around the town. All of that and more ahead this hour. But first this hour, Florida lawmakers have voted to enact new gun control measures weeks after one of the worst school shootings in U.S. history took place in South Florida. The state Senate has just narrowly passed a bill that would raise the age to buy a firearm from 18 to 21. It would also require a three-day waiting period for most weapons. Now, this push for gun reform in Florida comes after a recent spike in violent crime in this country, after it had actually been declining for decades. It's troubling. Interactions between citizens and police are too often ending in violence, particularly if those citizens are people of color. People are increasingly worried about safety, not only in their schools, but in their communities. Against this backdrop, last year, the National Issues Forums Institute invited communities across the country to participate in a national conversation. It's titled Safety and Justice: How Should Communities Reduce Violence? The Reverend Greg Kaufman of Orange Park represents the Kettering Foundation Research Associate, and he is a member of the National Issues Forums Institute. He's here now in studio with more about the findings that came out of that project. Reverend Kaufman, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Here's our question to callers. What are your thoughts about the gun reform package moving ahead in Tallahassee? What do you think is needed to reduce violence in this country? We want your calls. 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And we always welcome your comments as well. On our First Coast Connect Facebook page, just find that and let us know your thoughts there, too. And so, for the last several weeks now, all eyes have been on Tallahassee, Reverend Kaufman, as the Republican-dominated legislature, which has historically, you know, been averse to tighter restrictions on guns, has increasingly been hearing the call of citizens and students and their constituents about this, and they're starting to consider tighter regulations on this. This is just one piece of what you've been looking at with this safety and justice report that you've been a part of. And this was put together as the whole country has been growing more and more uneasy about violence in America. Can you tell me a little bit about how this report came about?
Yes. Well, the Kettering Foundation and National Issues Forum Institute was very concerned about incidents that took place in Ferguson, Missouri, and other communities around the country, either violence against citizens or police shootings. And so with that concern, the foundation, which normally publishes four or five issues every year, focused on the safety and justice issue and encouraged communities, centers for public life, universities and other organizations in 2017 to hold deliberative forums about reducing violence in their communities.
Everybody got a chance to give their opinion about this.
Yes. Deliberative dialogue is a form of civil discourse where small groups of people, 12 to 15, spend 2 hours talking with one another with the help of a neutral moderator. It's unlike debate where we sometimes listen as audience members to a pro and con binary argument, or it's very different than events, public forums, where there are expert panels, where we listen to wonderful people talk about their field of expertise. But again, in an audience format, we typically walk out having not had the opportunity to discuss the issue with one another. Deliberative forums are simply an alternative approach to engaging the public, where people really do have a chance to talk and listen very carefully to one another.
And out of that came this safety and justice report, which you've made a point of delivering to the local sheriff, the local state attorney, the mayor's office, and other local leaders.
Yes.
Two questions for you. One, what are the recommendations in this report? And two, what was the reaction when you took it around town?
Well, there were five general recommendations that came out of the report, and they correlated quite well to other communities around the country. First, the tone of the conversation was very civil, and people wanted more dialogue, more opportunities. They really enjoyed the dialogue process and being able to listen to one another. They felt that the issue of reducing violence was a collaborative enterprise. It was not something that they felt the police departments, and in our case, JSO, had the sole responsibility for. They felt that relationship building with the police was very important. They felt that, for instance, anti-bias training was something that we all would benefit from. Churches, schools, business community, as well as police departments. And they also felt that there were root causes to violence, lack of educational opportunity or achievement, economic opportunity and jobs, and a big issue, a big concern, of course, is mental health care.
All of these things are issues that we've known about for some time. And so this report really pulls it all together. These are all solutions that I think most people that have even a passing knowledge of this problem in Jacksonville, which, of course, we've been the murder capital of Florida off and on for going on 15 years now.
Yes.
We know what needs to be done. Everything you just said is part of the solution. And yet we continue year after year to be at the top of a list that nobody wants to be at the top of.
It's a question of priorities, I guess. And one of the opportunities for people in deliberative forums is to realize that, yes, many of these recommendations are certainly legitimate. But if you only have a certain amount of money or a certain amount of assets, how do you prioritize your response? Mm-hmm. You asked about the response to the report. I understand that the mayor's office and the sheriff's office are reviewing the report, but Melissa Nelson, state attorney, has responded, and I actually had a chance to meet with one of her attorneys last week. And they are very interested in the report, but also the process of deliberative democracy as a form of quality listening to the public, which is, it sounds simple and common sense, you know, a real kind of common sense piece. But we don't always listen very well.
Well, we try to listen on this program. We try to listen to our guests. We try to listen to our callers. And we hope you're all out there listening too. Lots of calls, so it sounds like you are. As we talk with the Reverend Greg Kaufman of the National Issues Forums Institute. Wanted to get that right.
It's a mouthful.
It is. Safety and justice. How should communities reduce violence? We want your thoughts on that. And also the gun reform efforts in Tallahassee as the legislative session winds down. 549-2937. Give us a call right now. John is in Riverside. Hey, John. Good morning.
Good morning. How's everyone doing this morning?
All right, thanks.
Fantastic. You know, one of the things I've been hearing what's been being said, and my personal feeling on it is it seems to be death by a thousand Band-Aids. I mean, we say there's solutions, but they don't really address the core root issues of the social problems we have. And I find it interesting. I'm not really suggesting this per se, but I think with the advent of technology and the advancement of technology, it's a possibility. we have licenses to get a weapon, for concealed carry, for a car, you know, basically anything dealing with our social and community, you know, responsibilities. Why don't we do the same thing with children? I mean, I know it's a very, could be a very edgy topic, but wouldn't it be wonderful to live in a world where every child that was conceived and born was loved and wanted and desired? I think that would eliminate violence virtually overnight. So I think some of our endemic problems that you can't solve with a million Band-Aids, because I've never seen a city solve these problems, even if they had all the money in the world, this is a reoccurring theme. Shouldn't we consider responsible reproduction and consider, you know, the social implications of children born into this world who are either undesired, accidental, or born into suffering? I mean, we need to consider the root. We're supposed to be evolving as a human species. So why aren't we evolving our practices of reproduction? That's that comment.
All right, John. Bob in Atlantic Beach. Go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, good morning. I run a nonprofit, and we provide vocational training for disadvantaged youth at risk. We train them to be merchant mariners. And I'm kind of wondering, having done this for a while, why we don't see more effort on the part of the city to provide training to community members who are obviously in socioeconomic distress and not going to go ahead through college. Thank you.
Yeah, you know, that's a great point. And when you talk about community building, that's one piece of it. Did this come up in the deliberative dialogue that you engaged in?
Yes, education is very important. And I'll give you an example of what we're trying to do. One of the outcomes of the deliberative forums was we had some people from the Baptist Health Wolfson Children's Hospital Tipping the Scale Adolescent Mentoring Program. They participated in a community forum that we had in September, and they became very interested in this process of deliberative dialogue, deliberative democracy, and invited me to work with their high school youth and their mentors. Mm-hmm. And so we've had now, over the last 3 months, three forums, the first with youth alone, and they deliberated the issue youth and violence. In January, we worked with the mentors, and they deliberated an issue called Making Ends Meet, about the wealth gap in the United States. And then just last week, we had a forum on kind of Jacksonville's history and historical legacy, the Confederate Monument issue, with both the young people and their mentors. And I can say that, like your caller, Bob, who works with young people, these young people took to this process of carefully listening and the ability to disagree agreeably with one another in a wonderful way.
Too bad their parents can't always do the same, right?
Exactly.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, so you're involved with that whole debate over the Confederate monuments. And do you see these two issues as being linked, the tortured racial history of this city and the violence issues that this city continues to grapple with?
Well, yes. One of the comments in many of the forums that was common was that there is a root cause to violence, and one of the root causes is the issue of race, and in some cases, poor race relations. And so the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and Leadership Jacksonville are co-hosting a series of forums on March the 27th, and they're called How Should We Convey the History of Jacksonville, Monuments, Parks, and People? We've had a number of forums with this issue, with Baptist Health Group of young people. We're doing one with Rotary Act, Rotary Young Professionals, next week. But the DuPont Fund and Leadership Jacksonville will bring probably about 150 people together at the end of March. And that issue of race relations and trying to lift up a common history of the city in a positive way certainly, hopefully, will go a long way to helping to get people to understand one another and ultimately reduce violence.
Violence, improving safety, the safety and justice report that's being reviewed by top officials in this city right now. What are your thoughts about this? 549-2937. Mylon is in Ponte Vedra Beach. Good morning.
Yes, good morning, Melissa. Good morning, Reverend.
Good morning.
Good morning. Yes. So I was listening to the program yesterday on the case being brought against the pharmaceutical industry, due to the opioid crisis. Now, why won't something similar be done, by the state against the gun industry, isn't this a form of terrorism? Isn't this the same kind of thing? I think citizens have to vote to get the politicians who will not take definitive action and ban semi-automatics at the very least. The raising of the age of 21. I don't know to what extent it will help, but I think the banning of semi-automatic weapons. Politicians. We have to vote and get these people out. And that starts at the very top with our governor Rick Scott, who's bought by the NRA. I'll take that offline.
Well, the measure that would have banned assault weapons went down in the state Senate, I believe 20-17. A couple of Republicans in the state Senate did vote for it. Of course, they were from South Florida, which was affected by the mass shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School, Milan. And you also asked about why can't people that are upset about these mass shootings sue the gun manufacturers the way local governments like Jacksonville are suing the opioid manufacturers. In 2005, Congress passed a law giving gun manufacturers near total legal immunity from being sued in that manner for crimes committed with the weapons or the ammunition that they sell. And so that's why that has not ever really happened in this country. But Greg Kaufman, obviously the report that you produced didn't deal specifically with the issue of mass shootings, but it did deal with gun violence.
Yes, and I mean, I'm not a legal expert, and I could not speak to the Milan's question about lawsuits. However, in our forums, one of the strong feelings was that gun violence needs to be considered as a public health issue. And there has been some controversy, some tension on whether or not to have, for instance, the CDC, Centers for Disease Control, research gun violence as a public health issue.
That's also been outlawed by Congress.
Yes.
Senator Dickey, who put that in, I learned this in my research and in covering this in recent months, the late Senator Dickey, who was instrumental in passing that amendment, it became to be known as the Dickey Amendment. On his deathbed, or as he drew near death, he later said publicly he regretted that law's passage because it basically prevents the CDC from studying the public health effects of gun violence. And there has recently been something of a bipartisan call to repeal the Dickey Amendment because of the types of things you're talking about.
I think that would be very helpful. We really need to look at this issue as a public health issue and hope for some expertise in the health field to help us grapple with the issue.
And let's go to a few of your comments on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. Here are a couple from Matthew. We do not do enough to prevent areas from being crime accessible. Simple things like keeping them clean. Take the downtown edge of the North Side, for example. La Villa's United Voice has picked up more than 12,000 pounds of trash there. We've had help from the city on just two occasions. We need trash cans. We need constant cleaning to help this area feel safe and not help criminals feel welcome. Secondly, according to JSO, around 60 guns have been stolen out of cars since January 1st in this city. Perhaps people who have their guns stolen so easily should not be allowed to own them when Jacksonville is seeing a murder rate of 120 plus people a year with guns and most of them stolen. So strong comments on our Facebook page there. Here's one on our Twitter feed from Travis. I believe the mayor is responsible for the safety and well-being of Jacksonville. Gun violence continues to plague this city, and we are hearing very little from Mayor Curry about his plan to reduce crime. Now, you mentioned that you've dropped this plan off to not just the mayor, but also the sheriff and the state attorney. What's your plan for engaging public safety officials, you know, and, you know, any official who's worried about this issue as you move ahead with this, Reverend Kaufman?
Well, the conversation that I had with the state attorney, it's not my place to describe their plans necessarily, but I will say that they're very interested in the process that we used, and they're very much wanting to get out into the community and do some listening in neighborhoods. And the issue of lighting, safety, the very things that were mentioned in the Twitter post there, are concerns that they have.
And the whole comment on Facebook, the whole idea of the broken windows theory of reducing crime, if a neighborhood looks clean and nice, that has an effect. That has a positive effect.
Absolutely. There's a JSO zone captain who personally is very, very concerned with abandoned houses and properties in Jacksonville. And he participated in our forum. I need to mention that when we convene forums, especially these safety and justice forums, we made a concerted effort to invite police. And they were wonderful. We had police at many of our forums, and they provided a perspective that was very important. In fact, one talked about this issue of people leaving guns in their unlocked cars, which seems to me to be just an unbelievable.
and JSO has really been pushing hard to remind people not to do that.
Absolutely.
Because clearly people are doing that and the guns are getting stolen. Let's go to David on the South Side. Hi, David.
Hello. I was wondering if the Reverend had ever had looked at the Boston Project, David Kennedy, the professor from Rensselaer College in New York Criminology, and I haven't followed him recently, but when we did the journey, he came down, and part of his report suggestion was to do a survey in the bad crime areas and find natural leaders and empower them and provide services through them because they're in the community and need and know the need and who is real and who is, maybe you call it, lost. And it was tough on crime, too. If they didn't reform, they could provide jobs. If the ones who were selling or doing whatever wouldn't take the job, they were prosecuted. But we copied all the things except empowering those in the local neighborhoods. In Jacksonville, if it's not in the politician's fingers, it is dissuaded to empower citizens in the community. And that is really the only thing that will change a little bit over time the problems we have, because there is no feedback from the community. Everything we do is from the top down, and anything from the bottom up is more or less ignored.
You know what, David? David, thank you so much for that. That is such an important point. And as I look at the Boston Project's website, their mission is corner by corner neighborhood revitalization involving local youth and adults in decision making and community action in their own neighborhoods. And he's right about that. As I think back on the Jacksonville journey, Reverend, I was on one of the subcommittees of that. And of course, it was a massive effort, and it was a sincere effort, certainly, to attack the homicide rate in this community. And it involved some very smart and gifted and wonderful people. But I do remember, at one committee meeting that I attended, people on this committee, were, let's be clear, came from white neighborhoods, affluent neighborhoods for the most part. I think there were maybe two people of color on this committee, and none lived in high crime neighborhoods. And everybody in the committee was invited to get on a bus and go tour these neighborhoods that were being most affected by buy this. And a lady named Hester Clark, you know, who is African American, spoke up and said, "What? We're all going to go slumming in the hood, and and that's going to give you guys a better sense of how this works." She kind of stuck her hand up and said, "This is, you know, come on." Yeah. So I remember that vividly, and honestly, it was that experience that motivated me years ago to make a documentary about the violent crime problems in this city. And it's frustrating for me because I thought in my naivete that, oh, I can make a project and that's going to wake people up about this. And of course, it didn't. We continue to have the same issues. And, you know, year after year, I sit here and I talk to the most amazing people like you who are so concerned about this. And we continue to have the same issues in this city. It's just so frustrating. So as David pointed out, the Boston Project, I think, hit upon something that needs to happen here, where you empower people in their own communities to take ownership of this in a way that maybe hasn't been done here before.
Well, yes, a number of comments in response to David and you. Number one, your documentary is remembered. I had the state attorney's office person that I spoke with mentioned that as very influential.
Well, that's good to know, at least.
So we wanted you to get that compliment. But I'm not familiar with the Boston Project, but I really appreciate the caller's comments. And one of the things that came out of our forums talked about the Newtown Success Zone in Jacksonville.
And that's modeled on the Harlem Children's Zone in New York.
Right. And I know that, I understand that the funding for that became minimal, but the project continues. And some of the police who were in the original relationship with that are still working with those people. I love the title of their block captains, Vision Keepers. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just think that's terrific. So that program is still going, and the state attorney is working with the Newtown Success Zone. I think to the degree that we can replicate things like that that have worked in Jacksonville, that would go a long way to speak to what David said. And then thirdly, deliberative dialogue is a grassroots process. Our forums are held in the neighborhoods where we go to people. We don't ask them to come to a downtown place. We hold them in churches, and the Atlantic Institute, for instance, hosted a forum. We had wonderful forums in Arlington near Edward Waters College. And so we went into those neighborhoods, and people from those neighborhoods participated. So I appreciate that the comment that he made. This is certainly not a top-down. It's an alternative to a top-down. It's very much listening to citizens and having the grassroots public's voice be heard and reported on to decision-makers.
Lastly, when's the next forum?
Well, the next forum is on March the 27th. It's at the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund. It's the forum on how should we convey Jacksonville's history, monuments, parks, and people from 6 until 8:30. There's a light supper provided. You need to call the DuPont Fund. They have an Evite. You can register for that. It's a free event, but we would encourage people to participate.
Come on out to that. The Reverend Greg Kaufman with the National Issues Forums Institute, and it's their Safety and Justice Report. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Much more still ahead on the show later. We'll tell you about a new app, Keeping Things Relevant. You need to download that. Also, it's Colon Cancer Awareness Month, what Mayo Clinic needs you to do to check your status. But up next, if you've ever thought about running for office but didn't know where to begin, Leadership Jacksonville has some tips just for you. We'll be right back.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Personal Injury and Wrongful Death Law Firm. When people are hurt through no fault of their own, answering who, what, when, where, why, and how is critical to proving the truth. More at waynehogan.law. New Horizons, offering IT programs designed to start your career in 3 months. Federal funding may be available. More information at newhorizons-jax.com or 564-9500.
I'm going 120 feet underground.
Are you claustrophobic?
No, not really.
Okay, because we're going to be in this elevator for about a minute.
A minute later, a huge Titan II missile, designed to carry a nuclear payload, looms above me.
You need to keep your situational awareness.
Nuclear weapons and the threat of war. On the next Reveal.
Thursday at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, inviting you to join me Tuesday nights at 9 for Turntable Tuesday, only at the Electro Lounge on 89.9, your community, your world, your music.
Well, it's a great opportunity if you've ever thought of running for office but seemed overwhelmed, didn't know where to start. You're in luck. A new series is coming up, a nonpartisan political campaign seminar. Now, this is sponsored by Leadership Jacksonville, and this series is producing graduates who have gone on to run, and at least one so far has won a local elected office. Jill Langford Dame is CEO of Leadership Jacksonville. She's here with more. Hey, Jill.
Good morning.
So you started this a couple of years ago, nonpartisan. You welcome people across the political spectrum, but it's with the idea of training people to run for office, right?
Right. We want to give them some ideas to think about before they absolutely commit to run, but also give them some general background knowledge as they plan to run. What do they need to know?
And people do go into this thinking, oh, I can do this. This isn't so tough, but maybe with a little bit of naivete. There's a lot more than people might realize to even run for a local office.
Absolutely. We had folks in our first class. We try to keep the group small. And we had folks in the first class that decided, you know, they might run in the future, but after they heard what all was involved, maybe not right now.
And they took a pass, really.
They took a pass for now.
Because it's a daunting climb up a hill, isn't it?
It is. You have to be very committed to running to sign on.
And what will people learn in this?
Well, they'll learn what they need to think about, what decisions they need to make. They'll hear from the supervisor of elections about the laws that are involved. We talk to them a lot about the impact on their family, so they have that in the back of their minds as they decide to run. We talk about fundraising and friend raising and some of the media background that they need to understand and know before they sign on.
These are seminars that you really tailored for local campaigns, too.
Absolutely. Northeast Florida. We had folks last time that are running in Flagler County. That's unusual. Most of our folks were running in Northeast Florida, Duval, out at the beaches. And it's a good program for that, but it actually works for Clay County, Nassau, St. John's, because some of the background that you need to know is the same.
Now, you've had a number of people go through this seminar who are currently running for office. You've had one graduate of this win office. It's Mayor Ellen Glasser of Atlantic Beach.
Right. She is the only one who took the course and has already completed her run. So right now we have a 100% success rate. Take the program and she won. So
why did LJ decide that this was something you felt was important to do?
Well, our mission is to educate, connect, and inspire folks to improve their communities. Many people do it through nonprofit work, but some do it through elected office. So we wanted to help those who are doing it through elected office. But we also put in a heavy dose of ethics and civil discourse so that we hope the people that are elected understand how important that is in service.
Yeah. And over the years, Leadership Jacksonville has had a number of alumni hold office.
Absolutely.
But they didn't have the benefit of this thing.
No, they did not. But they sure had the benefit of the ethics through our programs.
Exactly right. Well, you know, and you mentioned the fundraising piece. That is such a big part of it.
It is. And we don't tell them who to go ask for money, but we give them ideas, what they need to know, how they need to use and build their own connections to go out.
Mm. And when you see them go through the course, what's that like? How many sessions are there, and what's it like as they come in at the beginning versus what how they're looking at it by the end?
Well, there are five sessions, and when they start, in general, they're a little in the dark about some of the aspects of it, and they grow more confident during the five sessions. They're Friday mornings, 5 weeks. And by the end, they at least know where to start, who to talk to, and what their next steps are going to be. So a lot more confidence by the end of the course.
A lot more women are motivated to run for office this cycle than in the past. Are you seeing more women showing interest in this?
In last year's cohort, we absolutely had more women than men sign up. And they were very inspired by each other as they went through the program.
That's interesting because in the past, you know, women had to be almost dragged into running for office. They had to kind of really be recruited and encouraged and nudged into it.
Right. And I think now they know they need to let their voices be heard, and they're stepping forward with great candidacies. We've had some good people, and more are signing up every day.
But you want to stress, though, Jill Dame, this is a nonpartisan seminar. This is for all candidates, all comers.
Absolutely. We had Republicans, we had Democrats, and some of the races we had were judicial races or school board races where they are not running as a party representative.
Okay, so with all of that said, the Nonpartisan Political Campaign Seminar, sponsored by Leadership Jacksonville, is starting in April, but the reason you're on today is the deadline to apply is coming up fast.
Right. March 15 is the deadline to apply, and they apply online at leadershipjacksonville.org. Our link to the application is on the homepage.
Just go to leadershipjacks.org and apply if this interests you. If you're thinking of running for office, this is a valuable tool now being offered by Leadership Jacksonville. She's CEO Jill Langford Dame, and always great to see you. From the class of 2013, the best class, as you well know.
as I well know.
Thanks, Jill.
Thank you, Melissa.
All right. Well, it's the third most common cancer diagnosis in both men and women. And despite dramatic reductions in the disease overall, when it comes to colon cancer, striking disparities remain when it comes to the categories of both age and race. March marks Colon Cancer Awareness Month, and it is a call to action to get screened. With more, we're pleased now to welcome oncologist Dr. Pashtoon Kasi and Dr. Douglas Rieger-Johnson, both of Mayo Clinic here in Jacksonville. Gentlemen, good to see you.
Thank you for having us.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for being here. Dr. Kasi, let's begin with you with the good news. This is a common cancer for both men and women, but there have been dramatic reductions recently. What do you attribute that to at Mayo Clinic?
You know, thanks for bringing this up. As you know, March is the Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month. While you bring a very important issue of the decline that has happened, particularly in the individuals above the age of 50s because of the uptake of screening in terms of colonoscopy, at the same time, there's been a burden of disease shifting to the younger individuals, which is a cause for concern, and that is particularly very real. Individuals in their 20s, 30s, and 40s who otherwise wouldn't be screened with a screening colonoscopy or a stool test, that is where the rise is happening in the millennials, and more research is going into that topic as well.
And do we know what is causing that? Because you tend to think of it as affecting, like you said, people over 50.
You know, again, it is initially it was thought maybe it's because of we're detecting it early, but at the same time, you know, I'm seeing individuals in their 20s and 30s at least 2 to 3 a week. And it's not necessarily that we're detecting it early because often it's advanced at the time of diagnosis. Some people attribute that to the obesity, the change in diet. We have more carbs, less activity, maybe more antibiotics. Even in individuals, let's say, for example, who were born in Japan, but when they moved to the United States, you see a similar rise. So some of that is not necessarily genetic.
So some of it could be diet and lifestyle. Okay. But Dr. Rieger-Johnson, there is a genetic connection that you can share with us, right, when it comes to colon cancer, colorectal cancer?
Yes, there is. So approximately 5 to 10% of colorectal cancers are caused by hereditary traits that patients have inherited from their parents.
Okay. And how then, as we talk about this Awareness Month in March, particularly for people listening that are not 50 yet, and maybe they're tuning this out going, I don't need to worry about this. How would they even know if they fall into that 5 to 10%?
Based on their family history.
They need to know their history.
Mm-hmm. So if you have a relative with colon cancer, your odds for colon cancer go up. The odds go up based on the number of relatives with colon cancer and the younger they were when they were diagnosed.
Interesting.
So if you have a relative who had colon cancer at 50 and that relative was a parent or a sibling, you should start having colonoscopies not at 50, but at 40.
So not unlike breast cancer in that sense.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. So know your family history, get screened. Dr. Kasi, what are some other risk factors? Obviously, diet and lifestyle you mentioned. What else do people need to be aware of? Because this is the awareness month for this. And this is something that I think particularly can sneak up on a person. And I tend to think back to when Katie Couric was the anchor of the Today Show, and all of a sudden her husband just got deathly ill and died of this disease. And it just, all of a sudden he became sick. He didn't have symptoms until it was too late, which I think is why colonoscopies, getting screened, is so important.
That is very true. And you know, it's another interesting aspect while we talk about risk factors is colon and rectal cancer is such a heterogeneous disease. Even the left side of the colon is different than the right side of the colon. And in terms of, let's say, the right-sided colon cancer is more particularly seen in females, and echoing the genetic linkages, some of the genetic-based or familial cancers are more on the right side. So while a lot of times we think of colorectal cancer as one disease, actually, you know, in my mind, I think of it as three different diseases. And the risk factors, while there are some which are common, for example, lack of fiber in the diet, there are others which may be particular to, let's say, the right side of the colon.
Okay. Now, what are you going to say, particularly to the guys out there who, let's be honest, getting them to go in for these types of routine screenings, I know from my own husband, it's not the easiest thing in the world to get them to go and do this. What do you say to the men out there that are over 50 and they need to go and get this routine screening done?
You have to do it. I would say this not to the men, but to everyone.
To everyone.
To everyone. And I would add one of the barriers to having a colonoscopy is drinking the prep.
Exactly. Nobody wants to do that. So, yeah, people put it off and put it off and put it off.
So the good news, and I was sharing this to the people in the lobby here, maybe too freely, is there are new preps.
Really?
There are many new preps that
are less awful.
Better. That tastes good. I've drank them all.
You're saying that, you're looking me right in the eye while you say this. Like, you really mean it, doctor?
I mean it. I will bring one here and give it to you.
I'll pass.
Sharing one of these new preps to our fellows, and I had to stop them from drinking it because they said it tastes like Sprite. I'm like, you need to stop. Something's going to happen to you if you keep drinking this.
A friend of mine who's a woman just went and had her test done, and she told me, you know, that the prep solution was so awful. So she must not have gone to Mayo Clinic. That's all I must be able to say here. You guys have all the best stuff.
Well, I don't want to mention any brand names, but you should ask for the low volume preps. You can search that on the internet.
All right.
And they're available everywhere.
And we're out of time, guys. March is Colon Cancer Awareness Month. Get screened. Dr. Pashtoon Kasi, Dr. Douglas Riegert Johnson, both at Mayo. Thanks for raising awareness with our listeners. Thank you so much.
Thank you again.
Thank you.
Get screened, everybody. We'll be right back to tell you about a new app based right here on the First Coast, getting you relevant. That's after this.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Personal Injury and Wrongful Death Law Firm. Injuries can happen when you least expect it. For over 40 years, our attorneys have dug out the facts to help juries decide what happened and who's at fault. More at waynehogan.law. New Horizons, offering IT programs designed to start your career in 3 months. Federal funding may be available. More information at newhorizons-jax.com or 564-9500.
Jay-Z, Dr. Dre, and Diddy. American musicians, yes, but so much more.
Nobody knows hip-hop, and nobody knows the new American culture better than them.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Their real fortunes came outside the music industry, as it happens. the hip-hopization of American culture next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
On the next Fresh Air, the Steele dossier on Russian interference in the election and Trump's ties with Russia. We talk with New Yorker staff writer Jane Mayer. She writes about the bizarre twists and turns of how the dossier came to be, what the Clinton campaign knew and didn't know about the dossier, and why so little was done after Steele warned the FBI. Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
50 years ago, LBJ convened the Kerner Commission, laying out the dangers of a separate and unequal nation. Its findings were controversial and consequential, but how much has really changed? And what might it tell us about America today? Considering Kerner, what it got right and why it still resonates, next time on 1A.
Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, we want to tell you about a new app that is portable to any city in the country, but was developed right here in Ponte Vedra. It's called Relevant, and it's a location-based mobile network personalized for your interest. Think of it as like being for Yelp, but for local media. Winder Hughes is founder and CEO of Relevant, Inc., and he joins us now.
Good
morning. More about his creation. Winder, good to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
This sounds really cool. Tell us how this works.
So what happens is one has to download the app from the App Store, and that's where it is now. And what happens is users will discover local news, blogs, bands, artists, chat communities that's based on their interest locally. So it's good for the creators. They get discovered, very easily.
So it's like a real-time mobile magazine tied to your community. But say you go up to Charleston for the weekend, it'll switch over to that city.
That's exactly
and
right.
And you can tap into what's going on up there.
Yes. So those people up there, they get new audiences in all new ways that they would never, ever have before.
How'd you come up with this idea?
Lots of Chardonnay and lots of trial and error.
Is this your first app?
This is a version that is beyond one that we had before. And so it's been iterating. And now we feel like we have something that's, highly compelling, very differentiated, and we're just launching it now.
And by the way, this is spelled R-E-L-E-V-N-T, Relevant.
Yeah.
Just take out the A.
That's the cool way of spelling it.
Yeah. Well, you're cool, Winder. Now, here are some of the features of this. You empower content creators and media brands to put their content up right on your website, and they can distribute and monetize their content through your app. How does that work?
Yeah, so just like when you go like to GoDaddy or to web.com and you register your .com site with Relevant, you register your mobile domain. And so now it's connected onto our platform and you have this new mobile-first destination that's, far cheaper than having one's own app or your website.
Another thing that Relevant does is you can create a personal trending list to kind of keep track of your favorite topics, which isn't, I guess, unlike a news feed on Facebook or Twitter.
Yeah.
Right.
What is different about that, though, it's called Relevant Now. So rather than have like an email news list or something like that, you want to have your audiences mark your brand Relevant Now so that they always see your content all the time at the top of the newsfeed.
Now, obviously, you want people to download the app and use it, but you also are inviting people to contribute to it. How can people do that?
Yeah, so to get it rocking, what we started is a new brand. It's called 904 Now, and it's rolling out next week, and it's going to be North Florida's first mobile newsroom. So we've created a family of these specific communities like around live music, food and drink, surfing, all those kind of things. And so locals can also contribute if they want to, like, to those communities.
And that is not the same as 904 Happy Hour, right?
No, this is just our version of the brand 904 Now. But we're friends with those people.
You're going to be friends with a lot of people, I think. So people need to download the Relevant app at the Play Store. This is a free app, right?
It's on the App Store.
On the App Store.
Not on Android yet.
And Winder Hughes created this. And as I said, it's tied to this area, but it'll port with you all over the country, which is cool. So watch this as it grows, and good luck with it. Thanks for sharing it with us.
Thank you.
Again, that's Relevant without an A, and that's our show today. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board during the hour. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. And never miss a show. Download, or rather, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Or catch the rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock. Next on 1A, the West Virginia teacher strike is into its second week. How students are dealing with that disruption. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.